All right. I promised you for a while now that I'd tell you about the, you remember I went on that youth workers conference back in November, and I heard a guy, Francis Chan, talk, and I wanted to give you that talk. I wanted to tell you what I heard because it was good. And so you're going to get it this morning. Today's the day. And I want to start off by telling you a story about another pastor. I don't know his name, but I heard the story, who was out in California, I think in Simi Valley. And he was driving in his car. He had his little girl in the back seat. And he was driving behind an old man. He was a 75-year-old man. And they came up to an intersection. And the 75-year-old man hit a bicyclist. And he wasn't, like, seriously injured. He didn't break any bones or anything like that, but he knocked him off his bike. And this guy gets up, the bicyclist gets up and starts pounding on the front of the car and cursing and yelling. And the pastor's in the car behind him watching this thing happen. It's like, oh, my goodness. And the guy from the bicycle walks around. He opens up the driver's door and starts punching this old man and just beating at him and kicking him and cursing and screaming. And the pastor is watching this right in front of him, and he's like, I got to do something. And so he gets out of his car, and he walks up, and he starts to try to pull this bicyclist off this old guy. And he's still swinging. The bicyclist is swinging. And so now he's getting pulled off by the pastor, so he starts swinging at the pastor. So now the pastor's getting hit, and he's trying to push the pastor down on the ground and get him out of the way so he can go back to beating up this old man. Well, the pastor's kind of been pushed. You know, he's partway down on the ground, and he's thinking, what do I do? And just kind of out of nowhere, he just takes one swing, one uppercut, and clocks the guy in the face and knocks him out cold. And this is a busy intersection in California, and so all of a sudden, the whole intersection erupts with cheers and people honking their horn, and they're like, yeah! And I think, you know, I hear that story, and I think, you know, what if I was that, I mean, what if you were in that situation? Imagine you're that pastor and you've just knocked this guy out and people are cheering and honking and you're like the hero for the day. And I don't know about you guys, but I think, especially for guys, this is the kind of stuff that we dream about. I mean, to be in that situation where you can just be the hero for the day, you just take the bad guy out and you save somebody and you're just, you know, you're on top of the world. And, you know, on the other end, you know, imagine that you're in that car behind watching this unfold and you don't do anything. I mean, you sit there and you just watch it happen. I mean, maybe you think, you know, I really ought to do something, but for whatever reason, I think, well, maybe somebody else will help. And maybe you're sitting there and it does. Maybe somebody else walks up and all, you know, it doesn't have to be a fight. They just walk up and they say, sir, stop. And so he stops and it happens. And then aren't you for the rest of the day kind of like, man, why didn't I do something? Why didn't I at least try? I mean, imagine, even if the guy was, you know, some huge muscle-bound he-man, and you got out, and even if you got your butt kicked, wouldn't you be thankful that you at least tried something? I mean, I would. I would feel like such a loser if I just sat in my car and let this old man get beat up. I mean, it was an accident. It wasn't like he was trying to knock the guy off the bike, but it doesn't matter. It just, what was happening wasn't right. And I would feel like, man, I got to do something. And I've, you know, have you ever been in those situations where you passed up an opportunity like that? I mean, maybe you're driving on the road and you see somebody broken down and you don't stop. Or, I don't know, you know, a poor guy looking for a handout and you've got plenty of money, but you don't give him anything. You know, whatever it is, there's lots of those kinds of situations. And if you ever passed those up and then felt bad about it, you know, the rest of the day, you're like, man, why didn't I do something? Why didn't I at least say something? If you turn to Revelation chapter 21, we all come across those situations where, you know, at the very least, we should have opened our mouth and said something. Revelation 21 starts off, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had disappeared, and the sea was gone, and I saw the holy city. This is, you know, this is when everything's getting restored. And it says, I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, the home of God is now among his people. If you skip down a couple verses, it says, and the one sitting on the throne says, look, I am making all things new. And then he said to me, write this down, for what I tell you is trustworthy and true. And he also said, it is finished. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And to all who are thirsty, I will give springs of the water of life without charge. To all who are victorious will inherit all the blessings and will be with their God, or I will be their God, and they will be my children. But cowards who turn away from me, and unbelievers, and the corrupt, and the murderers, and the immoral, and those who practice witchcraft, and idol worshippers, and all liars, their doom is the lake that burns with fire and sulfur. This is the second death. Do you ever read something that just convicts you? I mean, look at those other things. We like to look at the witchcraft and the idol worshippers and the murderers and think, you know, I've never done that. I'm not so bad. But you read that, cowards. Have you ever been in that situation where you were just too afraid to do what you should have done? God says, you will be my children. I will be your father. We'll have that kind of relationship. It says that we will live with him forever, as long as you don't fail. It says to the victorious, as long as you're not a coward. It's kind of harsh. I've heard plenty of people talk tough in their lifetime. I've talked tough in my lifetime. You know, we think about that situation with the pastor and think, you know, I would have done something. I would have gone kick that guy's butt. But then real life presents itself, and that bravado melts away into cowardice. And I've seen plenty of people who talk tough, but they don't do anything. You know, even if it's not a violent situation, something small. I mean, parents cussing at their kids, or, you know, that you could just say, hey, it's not nice to cuss at your kids. You know, little things like that. And you say, why didn't I speak up? Why didn't I do something? How about when you read this book? Have you ever read this book and some of the stuff in it that it tells us to do and thought, you know, I should really do that. That's the way I should live my life. But then you didn't, for whatever reason. Maybe you were too afraid. You were lazy. You're afraid you'd fail, so you didn't even try. Are you at peace with that? When it's just you and God and nobody else looking at you, are you at peace with the way you're living your life when you read this book? How about when you read about the early church? Have you ever read about the early church in like Acts and those books that follow the Gospels? You ever wonder why, like, look at our church, you know, not just Chapelwood, but our church in America, and wonder, why aren't we like that? I mean, I read those about those people in the early church, and they were willing to lay it all on the line to help each other out. They would do whatever they could. They'd stand up against whoever for the church, you know, to help somebody in need or to spread the gospel, just to do the right thing. And they were all over it. And what do? We sit in church for an hour on Sundays, and then we go home. I mean, do you see something radically different when you read about the early church and then you look at ourselves? But when I come to church on Sundays, it seems like everybody's fine with that. And I've been to a lot of churches, and it seems like everybody's just okay with, you know, we'll come, we'll show up, go through the motions, and then go home. And they seem happy to limit church, you know, what church means, to a time slot, you know, once a week. Am I just weird to think that that's not right? Okay, good. And I don't think I'm wrong to think that either, am I? I mean, to read this and to think that's the way we ought to be, if that's the way it says, we ought to do this. Because sometimes it seems like we just play a game with this church stuff. You know, we read the Bible and it, you know, we have happy faces and it sounds good, but then what do we do with it? If I had never, ever been to a church, you know, never met a Christian, and then I got a hold of the Bible and read it, and then I went to a church, you know, I'd think, did I walk into the right building? Is this really, I mean, is this what church is? I mean, we have a nice service here. I've really enjoyed today, like watching the kids get excited about cookies and hearing the Gideons speak about what they're doing and our chance to support them and the special music and the music that we sing together. I mean, I like it here. I love it. But is that all there is? What's happening? You know, what happens at noon? And everybody goes home Monday through Saturday. Are we out? You know, Jesus said, make disciples. Are we making disciples? What about, we have Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. There's, you know, there's not near this crowd on those. What are we doing then? Is our Christianity only as strong as it's convenient for us? When you look at the Bible and then you look at church, what do you think? I mean, what comes into your head? I look at Acts. I read through Acts and I see the church as an unstoppable force. I mean, there was nothing going to stop those people. In Acts 1, you know, it starts off that they're up in the praying in the upper room, just, you know, waiting for the Holy Spirit like Jesus promised. And then all of a sudden it comes and they're speaking in foreign languages and they're just doing amazing things. And the crowd sees them and they're like, what is going on? And Peter preaches a message and thousands of people come to the church. People are selling their possessions to care for each other. You know, if people need something and their brothers and sisters are like, you know, we'll do what it takes. We're going to help you out. Nothing is going to stop us. Nothing is going to take us down. And they start getting persecuted, but that doesn't stop them. They're like, we're going to do this anyway because God told us to. And miracles are happening all over the place. And then, you know, we hear about some of the sin that creeped into the church. Remember Ananias and Sapphira? And God strikes them dead because he's not going to let that happen. Church, to these people, this early church, it was not a Sunday morning habit. Church was a way of life. And, you know, think about Stephen. Stephen started accusing the Jewish leaders, and they stoned him. And he's looking up to heaven saying, I see Jesus Christ sitting next to him. And they're throwing these big rocks at him. And he's like, you know, kill me if you want. You're not going to stop me from preaching. You're not going to stop me from telling the truth. And then you read about Saul, who started off saying, I'm going to take this thing down. I'm not going to let this church go. And God turns him around. And it's just like when Jesus said to the disciples, I am going to build this church, and the gates of hell won't stand against it. And you see that in Paul's life. You know, he went to knock this thing down, and God turned him around. And now he's building onto the church. And if you haven't read Acts, go home and do it this afternoon. Read it and see, and you tell me what you think about the church today. Nothing was going to stop these guys by living out the full power of the Holy Spirit. Remember reading about Paul's journeys and all the crazy things that happened to him. People, you know, he got stoned and shipwrecked and went without food. He was hungry, and he's getting beaten and thrown in jail and whipped, and you name it. And he keeps on trucking, and he's glad for it. He keeps going, and the church keeps growing and growing and spreading and spreading. And the Holy Spirit was just doing amazing things through these people. The church was an unstoppable force. Don't you think it'd be amazing to be a part of something like that? It was just rampant and wildfire, and no matter what was happening to try to stop it, it kept on growing and it kept on growing. It's kind of like, you know, in underground China, the people that meet in secret because the government's out to get them. Nothing's going to stop these people. There's millions of people meeting in secret places. And they're getting persecuted and thrown in jail and tortured, and they continue to grow. Nothing is going to stop us, they say. And then you look at our churches, and they look pretty stoppable. Just change the kind of music you play, and the church is dead. And pick the wrong instrument to put up here on stage and people are leaving. Turn off the heat or the air conditioning and nobody's going to come anymore. I mean, our church, there could be one person in the congregation that somebody doesn't like and they leave. You've got people these days hopping from church to church to church to church looking for the most comfortable environment. They want some place that they can just feel really good in. And then you read about the things that the early Christians went through for their faith, and you realize that this is pretty different from what we're doing. You call this an unstoppable force. Could our church today, you know, is ours a church where everyone wants to give their lives to do what Jesus is calling them to? Is ours a church that could stand up against the gates of hell, like Jesus said? Would we still have a church without the building? Would you still show up? You know, are people here because they They love the Word of God. They're so crazy about God. They read their Bibles nonstop and cannot wait for Sunday so they can come here and tell the other Christians about what they've been doing during the week. Is that what we've got on Sundays? Are you sharing your faith all through the week? Are you willing to die for this thing, to give everything for this thing? I remember hearing a story about a family. I don't want to pick on anybody, but I kind of have to. I don't know who it was, and I think they're gone. There was a family here who said, you know, if you play drums on this stage, we're gone. And the drums weren't played, and I think they left anyway. But people are leaving churches for stupid reasons like that and call ourselves followers of Jesus. When you think about being a follower of Jesus, do you think about the things that he told other people who wanted to follow him? If you remember, this is in Matthew 8, there was one disciple whose dad had died, and he said, I'll follow you, but I want to go bury my dad first. And Jesus said, you want to go bury your dad? Forget that. Let the dead bury the dead. We're moving on. And then there's another guy who wanted to say goodbye to his family first. He said, you want to say goodbye to your family? You can't be my disciple then. Unless, he says, you know, you don't start plowing and look backwards. And we're on a mission here. Jesus was hard. He said, the birds have nests, the foxes have holes. I've got nowhere to rest. You still want to follow me? Is that the Jesus that we follow? Is that what the church is filled with today? People who are that committed? Or is it filled with people who will quit as soon as they start to feel a little uncomfortable? If Jesus had a church in Rockford today, I think that this church would be bigger. Because there are a lot of people who would come here on Sunday mornings who wouldn't follow Jesus. His words were too harsh, and he asked for too much. And I think that would drive a lot of people away. There's a well-known story in Luke chapter 8 when there were crowds following Jesus around. They came from towns all over the place. And it says a great crowd gathered from towns. And all these people had come from different cities. And Jesus looks at the crowd, and he says, hey, I'm glad you all came. Bring a friend next week. No, that's not what he said. This is what he tells this crowd who has walked from all over to see him. He says, a farmer, this is how he starts out, a farmer went out to plant some seed. He scattered it across his field, and some seed fell on a footpath where it was stepped on, and the birds came and ate it. Other seed fell on shallow soil with underlying rock, and this seed began to grow, but soon it withered and died for lack of moisture. Other seed fell among thorns and shot up and choked out tender blades. Still other seed fell on fertile soil, and this seed grew and produced a crop 100 times as much as had been planted. If you've got ears, listen. And then he walked off. That's what he told the crowd. Now we read this and say, oh yeah, that's the parable of the sower. That makes sense. But I want you to think about what this crowd heard. Because, I mean, if you think about it, it's really weird. And people walked for miles to come see this guy. Imagine if you had just walked for miles because you heard about this guy, Jesus. You heard about the miracles he'd been doing and how wise he was and the things he's been saying. And you're there, and Jesus comes up in front of the crowd, and he's ready to speak, and you're just waiting for those words of wisdom to drip off, and you get to, and you'll maybe see some miracles and stuff. Thousands of people, and he says, yeah, there was a farmer throwing some seed out. Some fell on the path, and the birds ate it. Some got in the rocks, and it died off because it didn't have roots. Some was choked out by weeds and died, and some fell in the good soil, and it sprouted up and produced fruit like crazy. If you get it, you get it. And that's it. He just lays out this weird story and leaves. So the disciples, they're like, what was that? They go up to Jesus and they say, what are you talking about? What did that mean? And Jesus says something so wild in verse 10. It was Luke 8:10. He says, you have been permitted to understand the secrets of the kingdom of God. But I am using these stories to conceal everything about it from outsiders so that the scriptures might be fulfilled. They see what I do, but they don't really see. They hear what I say, but they don't understand. Did you catch that? Because the disciples are saying, why did you do that? And Jesus says, well, you guys understand there's a deeper meaning behind this. You know, buried in this parable, there's spiritual truth. And so you come after me and ask me about it. You want to know more. I spoke in a parable so that they'll see me, but they won't really get me. They'll hear what I'm saying, but they're not going to understand. So Jesus specifically, intentionally confused the crowd. That's what he says. Doesn't that blow your mind? I mean, I bet most of you thought that the parables Jesus used, I thought this before, were, you know, they're great teaching tools so that everybody can understand. Everybody can really get it. But that's not what Jesus says. He says, no, I tell these parables so that I won't have to deal with the crowds of people who just aren't really that committed. I don't want them to understand it, and I don't want them to know what I'm doing. And I didn't, you know, you guys wanted it. You guys came up and came after me to find out the truth. But they're just here for a show, and I'm not going to give it to them. As a pastor, I stand up here, and I try to explain things so that everybody can get it. I mean, I want the entire crowd to understand what I'm saying. Jesus says he confuses people on purpose. And the reason he does it is buried right in the story he told, right in that parable. He says to the disciples when they ask him, he says, okay, here's the point. If I'm a farmer and I throw a bunch of seed out on the path, you know, I'm throwing a bunch of seed out everywhere. Some lands on the path. Am I going to go, you know, am I going to water the sidewalk? No, of course not. That seed is lost. I'm not going to do anything else with it. So the seed is gone, and that seed is like people who, they hear this word, but they don't believe it, and the devil steals it away. So they're going to walk away, so I'm not going to waste my time with them. And if I throw some seed on the rocks, you know, it's not going to last. It's going to wither and die because the roots aren't deep enough. Am I going to spend my time fertilizing and tending rocks? No, of course not. Because one, they're like the people that one day when it gets too difficult, they're just going to ditch me anyway. Does any farmer go over to the borders of the field and, you know, where the grass and the weeds and the thorns are and starts tending to the weeds and fertilizing and watering? No. Well, neither am I, because, you know, why am I going to spend all my time with people who, you know, they say, we love you, but you love so much other stuff. You know, it's not going to last. The cares of the world are going to choke out their love for me. So I go to the good soil. I go to the good soil because it's going to produce the fruit that I want. That's what Jesus tells them. And he explains to the disciples, look, you guys are that good soil. You get it. You know, you knew there was deeper truth to hear, so you came to find out more. You came to understand this stuff and to find the truth buried in this. So I'm going to spend my time casting my seed to you and tending you and helping you to grow because I know it'll produce fruit. I know you'll then go on 100 times more and teach more people about this stuff. You're the ones I want to spend my time with. I'm not going to spend my life watering rocks and fertilizing weeds. So I enjoy teaching. I think it's my gift. I love being able to help people get it, to understand something. And when I can do that, it makes my day. When somebody else can really, you know, latch onto an idea because I've taught them, you know, I enjoy that. But I don't want to spend my time and energy watering rocks, fertilizing the sidewalk. So how much of my life is going into that? You know, wasting time. So I got to ask myself, am I brave enough to preach like Jesus? To just, you know, as a pastor, it's not going to be really helpful to me if I stand up in front of a crowd, give a message, and everybody walks out. You know, it's not going to do me very good as a job. But should I let that stop me from just saying it like it is? Should you? Skip ahead a few chapters to Luke 14, and we've got another big crowd. The disciples are there. They're like, okay, what's he going to do this time? You ruined it last time. Everybody left. I hope you do a better job this time, Jesus. Luke 14, down at verse 25, it says, great crowds, again, great crowds were following Jesus. And he turned around and he said to them, if you want to be my follower, you have to love me more than you love your own father, your own mother, You have to love me more than your wife and your children and your brothers and sisters, even more than your own life. Otherwise, you can't be my disciple. Unless you can carry your own cross and follow me, you can't be my disciple. Nice intro, Jesus. The first sentence, you've lost them all. People are already walking out. You barely even started your speech. If I step, Jesus, you know, if I stepped up here and there was a standing room only crowd, you know, so many people were coming to chapel with that they had to stand in the yard and listen through the windows, I would be like, this is awesome. Look at what we're doing. I would be thrilled. But when Jesus saw crowds, he didn't get excited. He got skeptical. And he says, how many of you guys are really the good soil? Most of you, you know, you might make some emotional decision, maybe, but the moment gets difficult, you'll just leave. You say you love me, but you're in love with so much other stuff. I'm just a side issue. You're never really going to grow. And Jesus looks at the crowd and he says, are you really sure that you all should be here? Because I don't know if you guys are really ready to follow me. So let's weed out the bad seed right now. Let's take care of it. Do you love me more than your dad? Do you love me more than your mom? Do you love me more than your little kids, your wife? Are you willing to leave them all right now for me? Do you think I'm that great? If Jesus were in this room today, he might say, you know, I'm going to walk out that door. If you want to follow me, know this. If you walk out that door with me, you might never see your family again. You might have to give up your home, your job, your spouse, your little kids. You might have to lose it all. And as a matter of fact, we might walk out that door together and pick up some crosses and walk to the closest hill, and we might be crucified together today. Are you ready for that? Are you willing to do that? Do you still want to follow me? And he makes sure that they understood this, because then in verse 28 he says, don't begin until you count the cost. Would anybody start construction of a building without getting estimates first and make sure there was enough money to pay the bills? Otherwise, you're going to get halfway through the building and realize you can't finish. And everyone's going to laugh at you and say, look at this guy, what an idiot. In the same way, Jesus is telling, you know, he's saying, I'm telling you about the cost up front. I'm telling you this ahead of time because I don't want you going part way and getting giving up. I don't want to waste my time with that. It's just because it gets too hard for you, I don't want to, you know, see you walk away. I don't want you to go part way and say, well, I didn't know that that meant I'd have to stay married, or I didn't know that meant that I couldn't keep living the way I'm used to, or why didn't you tell me that my family might hate me because I follow you? I didn't know all this. So Jesus, he says, I'm telling you ahead of time because I don't want you to have those excuses. Just because God doesn't give you everything you've ever wanted, and maybe even if God makes your life harder because you're following me, I don't want you quitting. Why build it halfway? Why even get started? Just quit right now. I'm telling you up front. If you're going to follow me and you hear what I'm saying and you think this is too much, don't even start building. And just in case they still didn't get it, he gives another illustration. In verse 31, he says, or what king would ever dream of going to war without first sitting down with his war council and discussing whether his army of 10,000 is strong enough to defeat the 20,000 soldiers who are marching against him? If he can't do it, then before the enemy shows up, he'll send a delegation to make peace. And then he says, so no one can become my disciple without giving up everything for me. Are you ready to die? He says. If not, then you should probably give up now. If you're not ready to battle the world, just join them. Make peace with them. But the rest of us, we're in a war. And we're committed. And we're building a tower. And it costs a lot. It might cost our lives. Know that. We don't have this war mentality these days. Not in America, anyway. Not in church. We don't think of ourselves as building an army. You know, things get stuff. We just start complaining. Like the Israelites in the desert. Man, God, why did you bring us out here like this? Imagine an officer leading his troops into battle. And a soldier comes up and he says, they're shooting at us! You know, they're throwing these things and they're blowing up and they're killing people. I didn't know it was going to be like this. The officer would say, what's wrong with you? We're in a war. What did you expect? And that's what Jesus is saying. Hey, expect a war. Expect hard times. It's going to be harder and harder to follow me. The world is not going to be very friendly with you. This chapter ends and down at verse 34 with Jesus saying, salt is good for seasoning. But if it loses its flavor, how do you make it salty again? Flavorless salt is bad for the soil. It's bad for even the fertilizer. You just have to throw it away. What can you do with flavorless salt? You can't throw it in the dirt because the dirt's good. Things grow in it. You can't even throw it in the manure pile because manure is good. It fertilizes. If you put flavorless salt on it, it'll ruin it. And Jesus says that, and he says, if you have ears, listen. What did he want people to hear? He wants us to hear, you guys are supposed to be the salt of the earth. You're supposed to improve things here. But what if you lose your flavor? What if you don't make a difference? What if you guys really don't have the saltiness to go all the way with me? If you're not ready to pick up a cross and say, I'll die with you, you're worthless to me, Jesus says. And he looks at this group of people and he says, what am I going to do with a bunch of people who won't go to the cross with me? What am I going to do with a bunch of flavorless salt? Think about what he's saying. Nothing to do with salt that's lost its flavor. You have to throw it in the trash because you can't even throw it out in the dirt. Jesus says, you're worse than dirt. He says, you're worse than crap. If I had a pile of crap for my garden and you're standing in it, he's like, get off. You're ruining my crap. That's what Jesus is saying. And he says, here's a question for you. Are you the good soil? Are you worth it? Are you worth watering and fertilizing and taking care of? Are you worth investing into? Do you have flavor? Are you salt? Do you have the salt to follow Jesus all the way? Let me ask you something else. Say I've got a little salt in here. There's just a tiny bit in this shaker. But this is the good salt. This is the salt with flavor. It's hard to see, but I've got a little salt here. What good is it going to do if we take this little tiny bit of good salt with good flavor, and then we've got some flavorless salt? This salt has lost its flavor. What good will it do if we take the good stuff and then do this? How does this help? You know, in churches that are just built in numbers, how does that improve us? I'll tell you why we do it. What it improves, it's so that we can walk around and say, look how big my pile is. Isn't that impressive? I mean, we like to do this, don't we? Be honest. We like to impress people. Look at my pile. Look how big is your pile? Look how big my pile is. Yeah, pile of what? But that's us. We like to impress the world, don't we? I don't want to be a preacher for four people. You know, I don't want to drive the crowds away. But I have to have the courage to tell it like it is, because it's pointless if I'm just wasting my time with flavorless salt. Are you ready to go the distance no matter what? What if you ask yourself that? Do I have the flavor? Am I the good soil? Am I ready to go the distance? Is it worth God putting something into me? Am I ready to invest? Or am I just here to make myself feel good by putting in an hour on Sundays? If we didn't have a building or a piano or an organ or the pews or, you know, if we didn't have any of the things that you'd think about when you think about church, if this was all gone, would you still come? If we had to gather out in the yard, we got a nice day today, but what if it was raining? Would you gather in the rain to worship God? which gather in the snow in the winter. Have you ever seen the Chicago Bears play in a storm? People will sit in a storm for 4 hours because they're so fanatical about football. The Packers fans are even worse. I mean, it's always storming up there. And they'll pay money to go sit out in the cold and the snow. They'll take off their clothes and paint their bodies because they are so excited, for they love their team. Do you love God? Do you love the church? Do you have that kind of excitement? Do you give Jesus the same kind of attention that you give the Cubs? Would you sit out in the yard in the snow and the cold and the wind and cheer on God? Because that's the kind of church that I want to be a pastor of. That's the kind of church that I want to work with. They give everything to follow God. Nothing is going to stop them. An unstoppable force. The early church, man, they didn't leave just because it got tough. Just because somebody played music they didn't like. Because somebody changed the service times or did something different. And if they did, Jesus wouldn't have wasted his time with them. This book seems pretty clear on how we should live, on how we should act, on how we should be the church. Jesus said, I want you to live different from the rest of the world. I don't want you to be anything like the world. I want people to see it, to see you, and to know something is different. And I want you to show it with your life. You know, the world can do what it wants. The world is going to do what it wants. But my people do things differently. They're not like the world. We look at our neighbor and we love him. In fact, he's more important than we are. That's how we treat him. We give. We don't stockpile cash when brothers and sisters are starving to death. No, we help them. That's not the, my people act that way. They don't act like the world. They believe, you know, whatever I have, if I give it away, God's going to take care of me. That's how they live. When our economy is all screwed up, I don't have to worry because I've got the provider. People say, but what if, you know, what if I give everything away and I starve to death? What if that happens? Well, what if it does? First of all, Jesus promises it won't as long as you seek the kingdom first. But second of all, what if it did? You know, what if Jenna and I gave all our money away? You know, sold all our possessions and gave them to the poor, and we're starving to death. She says, honey, I'm so hungry. I don't have any food. And I say, me either. And we die. You know, maybe somehow God overlooked us. He was busy. And we starve to death. And then we're standing in front of God, having starved to death for the kingdom. I think we're going to be pretty fine after that. God said, I want my people to live that way. That's what my people are like. That's what my kingdom is like. It's always been that way. God's people create a different culture. You know, he didn't say, I want my glory to be shown in the individual Israelites. I want my glory to be shown in Israel. We're a community. Christianity is not a private personal relationship. Christianity is a team. We're a body. It's a public demonstration of what God is like. Together, God said, I want to show my glory through my people. He wants you to look at me as your actual, literal brother, to be a family. Remember, Jesus was at the house teaching, and some people came up and said, your mom and your brothers are here. And Jesus was like, who's my mom? Who's my brothers? You guys are my mother and my brothers. Because you hear the word of God and you obey it. That's what makes my brothers. That's what makes my family. It's deeper than a blood relationship. That's the way he wanted our church to act. I'm not trying to bash churches. I'm not trying to make us look bad. There are enough people bashing churches out there and complaining about Christians. That's not my goal. I just want us to live the way the church is described. I want this to be our lives together. I love the church. I love you guys. I mean, I really think of you like you're my family. You're supposed to be my family. Jesus Christ died for the church. And I want us to produce fruit for him. I want his death to be worth it. I want what we do to make God happy, because we're doing whatever we can. We're doing everything we can to serve him. I want to be a part of what Jesus started. I want to be in a group of salty Christians with real flavor, real brothers and sisters, the good soil that's worth tending, that's worth fertilizing and watering. And trust that with just the good soil, whatever amount we have, with just that piece of good soil, we'll produce a lot more fruit. I'd like to believe that I'm unstoppable. Don't you want to believe that about yourself? You know, so it doesn't matter if I lose everything. To be like Paul, take it all away. Beat me, throw me in jail. I'm going to keep going. Or like Stephen. So it really doesn't matter if people attack you or try to kill you. I'm not going to stop. If you want to follow Jesus so much that you'll go to the cross with him, if you love him that much, would you say anything? Would you do anything for him? Maybe I'm crazy. Or maybe you think I'm crazy. That's fine. You don't have to accept what I say. You don't have to accept me. You can do what you want. But I really believe that there are those of you in this room that believe with all your hearts that everything in here is true. And that you, maybe you've looked at this before and thought, you know, something is different. And I want to be like this. You know, some people are just not going to change. It takes a lot of courage to change. It takes a lot of courage to do what God has called us to do, because it's not always easy. Most of the time it's not easy. But at the end of the day, I don't want to be a coward. I don't want to waste my time thinking throughout the day, you know, I really should have said something. I wish I had. I wish I'd have done something. Even worse, I don't want to wind up in eternity regretting, you know, thinking, why didn't I let go of the world? Why did I have to hold on to it and trade my soul for it? Why couldn't I see how worthless the world was and go after what God told me to do? I don't want to do that. I hope you really think about this stuff. I hope you really think about it. I mean, I can talk and you can go home and go back to regular life, but I hope you'll stop regular life and start thinking about the way we're supposed to live. Pray for courage to do the right thing. Pray for intimacy with God so that he can speak right to your heart and you know what to do. You know where to stand up.